Dan, do you mind if we change this interview to just in memoriam of Barbara Bush? Yeah. Like your thoughts,
that's
please.
That's coming.
Do you remember when the Superdome thing happened and she was like, well, this is like better for them.
Oh, yeah.
That they get to live in
jackpot.
The football stadium.
You got to come to fucking Houston.
Hey, here's the thing about me, dude. If you have a fucking problem with this, I literally think Barbara Bush is the same way she was portrayed in The Simpsons. You have a counter argument to that? I thought not.
Felix, I should congratulate you on Spin Magazine confusing it with the rapper Logic.
I love that, I love that when that happens. It's one of those things that only gets funnier to me every time. He's one of those guys who's like a good technical rapper, but he's like, I'm going to rap about psychology.
Oh, yeah, but he was on Rick and Morty, though.
Yeah, he's the Rick and Morty rapper.
Yeah. You mean the cool one?
Yeah, he's the high IQ rapper.
Is there going to be a Rick skin on Fortnite? Is that going to happen?
No, but I've already unlocked the Bill Maher skin.
Hello, friends. It's your Chapo for the week. We've got a jam-packed show for you. We've got a double shot of interviews for you. First up is Dan Finn to discuss the rather spurious allegations of anti-Semitism being leveled against Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party. And then after that, we'll be talking with Eric Blanc about the Oklahoma teacher strikes, how that's going, the future of that, and as well as teacher strikes ongoing around the rest of the country. But before we get to either of those, probably the most pressing international news at the moment regards our recent airstrikes against Syria. So without further ado, we finally let Felix tell the truth about Syria. Chapo, let's go.
I was laughing that Assad is stupid Fortnite guy. Because when I was reading the article, it was like, reading the reports of it, it's like, they hit his secret chemical weapons base. And it's like, sounds like a pretty bad secret. But then I was thinking about Assad last year at conferences. He was like, damn, whatever you do, don't hit my secret base. Y'all can't know about that one. And then when they hit it, last week, he was like, damn, this is such a hassle.
No, it reminds me that there actually is a way that we could have stopped this. I mean, some people have blamed us, literally, in part anyway, for allowing this to happen by not talking enough beforehand about how there shouldn't be attacks on Syria.
Trump does listen to every episode. Well, he has tweet alerts for us.
See, that's what I realized, though. I think, obviously, that's not true. Nobody in positions of influence listens to the show. But Fortnite, you, Felix, if you could get Baron on your Fortnite squad and then tell him the truth about Syria, he would then tell Donald, and that could literally save the Earth.
I'm not bumping anyone. I'm not
you're
bumping
also
Chet.
You're implying Chet that Donald Trump is an involved father.
Yeah, like Donald Trump talks to his kid. And also, yeah, no, I'm sorry. I bet Baron's like, okay, but I'm not bumping Chet. Chet was a Halo pro.
Wait. Baron is okay? That is bullshit.
You think he's like great at it? You think he's like a good panic builder?
He's amazing. I guarantee you Baron is an amazing Fortnite player. I look in his eyes and I just see it. He's got that shirt that says the expert. He's talking about Fortnite.
Before we get accused again of skirting the most important issue of the day to talk about Fortnite, you know, the United States with Great Britain and France launched about 100, quote, precision missiles at Syria from cruisers in the Mediterranean on Friday night. We saw about 9 o'clock Trump address the nation and said, you know, the gas-killing animal Assad has gone too far, and we're going to do strikes against his air force and chemical weapons facilities. It's sort of a replay of almost exactly a year ago when Trump first launched airstrikes on Syria. This is, I guess, a slightly bigger version of that.
Yeah, we don't have casualty numbers yet. It's still murky. Like, there is a reason that you shouldn't immediately react to every input you get on this war, because everyone's like, oh, it's the most documented war in human history. And it's like, yeah, you can still be misinformed. You can still not get
probably because of that.
Yeah.
Totally.
But Yeah, so we did hit, apparently we hit a very populated suburb, but I don't know what the casualty numbers on that. It probably will come out right as a
suburb of Damascus.
Out. Yeah, right suburb. Outside, yeah. And there's debate over whether we actually directly hit a Hezbollah camp or not. And if we did, apparently it was totally evacuated. The point is, a lot of it seems like we hit a lot of empty buildings. And a lot of the response I've gotten from that I've seen from this has been, this is what you stand up against, hitting the empty buildings. And it's like, well, yeah, no, these strikes are like kind of stupid sideshows in a way. But we did a lot of similar strikes like this on Iraq in the 1990s. And the reason that they're bad is because it sets this precedent, like, that all the strikes before that did as well. Like all the times under Obama we hit them, or when we dropped that fucking bomb on the mosque in Aleppo. I mean, that wasn't against the Syrian government. It was against the news, but we still killed a shitload of civilians. Or when we hit Mosul like we did last year and just fucking iced hundreds of civilians. The reason all these are bad and the reason that you see people freaking out about these in particular, and you can make a lot of, oh, well, this is hypocritical. I personally don't think the anti-war movement in the U.S. is so strong that I want to fucking armchair quarterback it right now. But it's because it just becomes a normalized, we love that word now, normalized, running thing of like, yeah, every year, 6 months, we're going to hit this part in Syria. And then when the time comes that we actually do a ground invasion, because policy changes, you know, but we didn't used to have such a strong oversight and role in the Saudi intervention in Yemen under Bush, and then we did. Because if there's precedent for these things, and if there's a running thing that's we see as normal, it becomes easier for the state to do it.
Yeah, Felix, I agree with you. And I think we talk about this a lot, about hypocrisy not being a good political strategy. First of all, because no one likes a smug asshole.
Right.
And second of all, because people aren't consistent ever. None of them. This doesn't make any difference. But there is something truly shocking about, like, okay, France is there, which is hilarious because half of the people freaking out over Trump doing this are like, Macron is my boyfriend. Like, I mean, there must be a way we can point out the fact that there needs to be some kind of consistent attitude towards war without being, well, you didn't care about X, because those people are also completely politically useless and are not going to bring anyone over to this. I mean, we really are starting from scratch right now trying to produce an anti-war movement. I literally have no idea how to do it.
What I find interesting about the reaction to these current airstrikes and the fact that Trump is doing them, obviously when I watched that press conference, his address to the nation on Friday, I felt sick to my stomach thinking about what might happen should this idiot decide to take too big of a bite and actually kill Russian soldiers or artillery or something like that. I mean, again, the potential for this to spiral out is, of course, great, or it could just be one of these, and I think that what you said, the word normalized, this kind of almost ritual quality to these airstrikes and the way it's being talked about. I just wanted to bring up two examples of these sort of liberal foreign policy establishment that consider themselves anti-Trump, consider him the grave threat to American democracy and agent of Russia, etc., but nonetheless support these, quote, precision airstrikes on Assad because they think the use of chemical gas is so beyond the pale and so ghastly that only America can enforce those norms. I just want to
By the way, rebels also used gas on Kurds in this exact war, and we've hit opposition groups before, but we did not hit them for that.
Powerful duo, though, Anne Marie Slaughter and Samantha Power. Slaughter and Power.
Yeah.
Perfect Dickensian names for these two. Anne Marie Slaughter says, I believe that the U.S., U.K., and France did the right thing by striking Syria over chemical weapons. It will not stop the war, nor save the Syrian people from many other horrors. It is illegal under international law, but at least it draws a line somewhere and says, enough.
It's just morally and legally indefensible, but at least we're whipping out our dicks and putting it on the table.
And then the next one, Samantha Power says, I see the case for opposing U.S. strikes in hashtag Syria. Trump is anti-Muslim, deceitful, trigger-happy. He lacks a Syria plan and any seeming regard for international or domestic law. But please share views on what the U.S. should do to deter chemical weapons massacres.
Nothing.
He may be stupid as fuck, fat, lazy, racist, and cheat on me, but he's still my man. Keep your eyes off him.
I mean, we could get rid of our chemical weapons as a show of good faith. That's one idea. That's a starting point.
We could not sell them to other countries, not help other countries
that do use them. That'd be nice.
My favorite thing I saw, was this Slaughter of Power, the one that was like, I'm surprised that Iran would back up Assad. After he used chemical weapons, after it was used on them in the Iran-Iraq war. And it's like, first of all, I wonder who has the bill of sale for those weapons then. But also, like, what a fucking dumb argument. It's like, oh, yeah, it's pretty surprising the United States government's used bombs after so many of their Marines died in Beirut in the 1980s. Wow, you really got them there.
Yeah.
What I think is so interesting about Power and Slaughter here is that they both acknowledge that this is illegal. I mean, I know international law is sort of
a fig leaf.
It's a fig leaf, but they're saying
It's for babies.
It's
blatantly illegal
by the standards of international law, unconstitutional by our own law. Slaughter even says it won't help the Syrian people or stop the war.
No more
but
perk.
They all think that it nonetheless is the quote right thing to do, because for them, like, the thing that absolutely cannot be acknowledged is the idea that the United States can't and really shouldn't try to stop these quote chemical weapons massacres. Like, we are the absolute authority in the world to you know, enforce that norm by any means necessary.
Yeah, an arbitrary norm, because the fraction of the people killed in the Syrian civil war have been killed by chemical weapons, and you could kill another 100,000-200,000 people with conventional weapons and it wouldn't cross any lines, so it would be fine. But I think what this really shows is so much of the elite opposition to Trump is, we know it's aesthetic. They don't like him being president because he's grotesque. But beyond that, they even know deep down that not only are you only grossed out by him because he's this disgusting huckster, but you don't even think he really has power. This guy that you know is corrupt and ego-driven and maniacal and
possibly senile.
Possibly senile, at least deeply stupid. You're comfortable with him sending cruise missiles into the heart of a war that features other nuclear powers.
Yeah.
And not be too worried that it's going to trigger World War III, and because you know that he's not really in charge of this. He knew that this imperial military system operates under its own logic and under the supervision of its own real deep state, the military state, and that he's essentially a hood ornament. So it really makes you have to ask people like this, why do you give a shit about Trump anymore? Like, why do you care that he's corrupt? Why do you care that he's dumb? If you know that he's just the asshole in the front of the White House moving around the steering wheel without it actually piloting anything, then why do you fucking care?
I have a theory about this. I think it is to maintain the exact same foreign policy line, etc., and to maintain the status quo, but to say, yeah, but because they know it's not going to be popular. I mean, this is not going to produce the sort of daily life that most Americans are extremely excited to wake up and face. But with Trump there, they can be in charge, yet also greet people's complaints about the way the government is operating with, well, it's because it's this guy.
Mm-hmm.
Let us put together like a sensible Republican, you know, maybe just like a moderate. They could easily find a Democrat who would have the exact same policies easily.
Well, we know for a fact that Hillary Clinton presidency would have involved strikes on Syria by now, at least as many as we've seen. Maybe
I think
more.
We'd be in Venezuela if.
Maybe.
Yeah, maybe.
Don't hold your breath, because Mike Pompeo gets in there. I mean, we're already in there in some capacity. We're already in all these places in some capacity. We have over 5,500 contractors in Syria. One contractor for every U.S. troop we have there. We're already in all these places. And we're Operation Condor 2 is just starting. But yeah.
All I got to say to that is, but her emails.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. She tried to warn y'all. when she was running for president against the other guy. God, shut up.
But what I find fascinating about what you're saying, and the slaughter and power line and the sort of foreign policy blob that considers Trump a dire threat to democracy, but nonetheless seems to support his ceremonial bombing of a country in a civil war, which, as you said, also includes Russia and Iran, is that like there is this almost ritual quality to it, mm-hmm. where it doesn't matter who's giving the orders to send these cruise missiles into Syria. What we're really doing, it doesn't even really even matter who the actors are. What they're really doing is enacting a kind of ritual by which America once again gets to say that we are the elites that decide what is good and bad in the world. And just by shooting those missiles, like, we are telling not just the rest of the world, but what we're really doing is telling ourselves that we're still good and that our foreign
in
policy
charge.
Elites
More
are
even
still
than good.
In charge.
This whole thing is a ribbon-cutting ceremony.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's very unfortunate event. President Donald J. Trump, he did the Independence Day speech about...
It's perfect, too, because he loves a ribbon-cutting ceremony. Yeah. He's like, I get to sign something.
Yeah, he did that. He did the Independence Day speech about how we have to stand up to not let innocent people be killed. We have to stand up with our friends Israel and John Bolton to not let that happen. And then he talked about how he could have fucked Cheryl Teagues, and he got into a Harrier jet, and he just crashed into the ceiling and immediately exploded.
He tried to do the vertical takeoff in the hangar, yeah. and it exploded.
He's like, yeah, this Air Force guy was like, Mr. Trump, don't touch the throttle. He's like, okay, great, very great. Thank you. Wonderful day. I was the best pilot in New York. Also, in other sad news, John McCain was just doing a solo Cessna prop flight in Arizona, and he somehow crashed in Damascus.
If these anti-Trump NADSEC people were a little smarter, they would realize that they should keep Trump president forever. They should eject him with stem cells or stick his head in a jar.
Yeah,
and
he's
have
great
him
for
be
them.
The fucking
they
face
get to be like, oh,
this.
We don't like it either, but yeah. then he just keeps doing.
Right?
Yeah.
The ideal situation is to have this horrifying, grotesque ogre that you can dump all of the bad consequences of the eternal imperial foreign policy onto, because he's the one who's fucking up the implementation, but still have the actual policies that are necessitated by the logic of the empire.
Yeah. When Trump is president for life, when it's just his head on a Tosimo machine, they'll have what they want.
He'd be on a Sibian.
People say
his head on the Sibian, but he's just going up through his neck hole, so his head is.
And
on
he's
a
addressing the
crunch.
He's like, ladies and gentlemen, we're nuking Caracas.
Did you guys see the clip of Glenn Greenwald talking with Eli Lake on Al Jazeera?
He got owned so bad.
First of all, Eli Lake, looking beautiful. Looking beautiful.
Some people, like, they don't photograph well, but you see them, like, in motion, just gorgeous.
There's a point in it where Eli Lake's trying to say, like, Glenn made the point that if, you know, Assad is so bad and we care so much about his terrible massacres, our good allies, Israel, is literally shooting journalists in the head for approaching a fence and then cheering about it and watching, like, laugh, like, soldiers watching and laughing.
Civilians
posted
up.
Gun down civilians.
In deer stands with popcorn.
Yeah, yeah. And even more than that, our good friend Saudi Arabia, their charm offensive, their wonderful new prince, is carrying out what many are calling the worst humanitarian disaster in the world right now. Eli's response to that is, look, our allies, for all their flaws, are not perfect. And then he tries to start into a second point, and Glenn just goes, oh, they're just flawed, Eli. There's simply just a few imperfections there. And then Eli
It's like how Matt sometimes eats off your plate, or I leave the doors open.
And then Eli follows it up by saying, I don't think you can compare Saudi Arabia to Iran, because Iran is responsible for the deaths of 2,000 American troops in Iraq, because they gave all those shaped charges to the insurgency.
Ah, yes.
And Glenn Greenwald said, what were those troops doing in Iraq, Eli? And he goes, securing a constitution, protecting a government. So it's like, you can't compare Saudi Arabia causing a famine that is killing probably a million people.
What about the 3,000 Americans on fucking lower Manhattan? who were not invading a foreign
yeah,
land.
Well, we didn't even get to Israel yet. I'm just kidding, everybody. I think the Black Eagle Trust Fund did it.
Again, anyone who is trying to make this argument that, like, oh, we just simply have to do something about Assad, they're talking out of their ass. Like, I don't get why, even if you believe that we have to, or something has to be done about it, why the fuck could you possibly think that America would be the ones to do something about it or make it better?
Well, here's something we could do. We could let in more than 11 refugees.
Yeah.
We could let in refugees that aren't millionaires. That's a lot of the ones we let in. A lot out of the 11 were millionaires.
Yeah, again,
we should still be let in, but yeah, we should
let in refugees, yeah. and then a massive policy of geographic ignorance built into our public education system, because people always do this dumb shit where they're like, people can't even find North Korea on the map, and then they pull people who can't find North Korea on the map, and they pull people who can, and the people who can are like, by the way, we need to do something about them, and it's like, you know. This is why you should be somewhat skeptical of anyone who claims to be an expert in any kind of region or foreign policy, because usually they become an expert because they're fascinated with the conflict of the area and they want to, you know, to a man with a hammer. And it's just, you're not going to find something. You're less likely to find a sensible foreign policy position from someone who has spent 20 years studying a region. It's just, it's
well,
literally
they're also,
true.
They're also getting paid by one of the forces in the region with the vested interest in proposing their side of it.
I mean, that too. But I mean, it's the same thing with university, like with media, like anyone who gets really fixated on foreign policy. Like there is a good, I'd say a 4 out of 5 kind of chance that they end up arriving at the conclusion that, well, that means we need to go there.
Again, it's just when it comes to this, you know, foreign policy apparatus, they don't seem to care who's in charge as long as they perform these ritual acts of America being tough and exhibiting leadership on the world stage. And they don't seem to care that it's carried out by a unitary executive that's now largely completely untethered from Congress or the Constitution or even any democratic accountability. And they don't even mind that the person in charge of it is a doddering lunatic who they regard to be a danger in every other respect. So, I mean, again, it's sort of an old chestnut, but it just brings to mind the old, you know, adage, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. Like these Libya, Iraq, like the list goes on and on. Like, did these people ever think that some good is going to happen out of this, or they're finally going to get to the moment where like they get to be like FDR or like the World War II conquering heroes or something?
The point really isn't the outcome for these people, for just the more rank and file cable news talking heads. The point for them is that it feels reassuring and strong in a way to call for airstrikes, to see them meted out with the same fake precision that we always say that we have. It feels good to speak with this authoritative manner on what needs to be done. And then for everyone above them who's actually part of the state or part of arms manufacturers, they directly profit off of it.
Just to return to the Samantha Power thing, which I think is very indicative, she says, please share views on what the U.S. should do to deter chemical weapons massacres. Like, the onus is on us to be like, well, I don't know what we can do to deter
them.
Yeah, I don't know that we should.
We're just like, really good at making things better. That's our biggest talent as a nation.
Yeah, the sane answer is, I don't know what we can do to stop that.
Throwing fucking kindling onto the fires
exactly.
of this goddamn conflict.
Why isn't the question the first part of her statement, which is, I see the case for opposing U.S. strikes, and then lists all the reasons it's insane. So why isn't the question to her, Samantha, why don't you come up with an answer about what good you think this is going to do?
Yeah, why should we?
It's not going to deter these fucking... it blew up the chlorine factory. I guess he'll just go back to killing people by the thousands with regular bombs and guns. And this is like the classic Samantha Power thing where she writes an entire book on a problem from hell, you know, U.S. policy and genocide, and doesn't even devote a single chapter to any of the genocides actually carried out or abetted by the United States. She doesn't mention Indonesia, in her book at all.
Yeah, no, that's the thing we see now. It's like, why aren't the same people who are against these airstrikes, why aren't they talking about Russian airstrikes in Syria? Or why aren't they talking about Assad's? Maybe because everyone, the measure that you want to oppose those with is a ground invasion or a no-fly zone. Maybe that's why. And maybe because we're talking about our country and what our country aids and abets. But this idea that you have to condemn every single thing. I'm against all bad things. Okay, great, thanks. But by the way, people who also pulled out the, this is whataboutism on everything else, do this. What do you think the effect would be if there was a protest with like 1,000 people in America against Russian presence in Syria? What do you think the effect would be? Would it be nothing? Would it be less than nothing?
You know, speaking of what one can and can't affect in terms of, you know, the countries that we live in and whatnot, I would say, even if you don't think it matters, if there is a protest against U.S. intervention in Syria anywhere where you live or that you can attend, I would say do that. I think it's important for yourself to be seen and heard about this, even if it's not nothing, but it is something. And just, again, the only sane position on this is 100% opposition to any U.S. intervention.
And also, if you go to a march, and I'm not saying you have to go to a march or whatever, but if you go to a march, there is literally zero chance that it will kill anyone. So you're already being more of a harm reductionist in terms of foreign policy there.
Well, the good news for everybody who is a little worried, all these power slaughter people who were a little worried right before the bombs started falling that Trump was serious about his, we're leaving Syria immediately. We're getting the ground troops that are in northern Syria out ASAP. Emmanuel Macron has just said that he has convinced Trump to stay in Syria long term with the troops that we have there in northern Syria. So that's good news.
Great.
For everybody. I mean, you can take that with a grain of salt because Emmanuel Macron is a self-glorifying maniac, and Trump doesn't literally have, you know, a continuity of thought between two consecutive seconds in his life. But that's what he's saying now.
Really, really sad news. I'm getting just after your bulletin. Emmanuel Macron has given himself entire body cancer by stepping into a nuclear reactor to become Dr. Manhattan and win the Syrian civil war.
He rules.
Yeah,
he's like, I am king of Jupiter. Yeah. let's make the Vatican in charge of France again.
Honestly, like, when I thought he was like a boring like neoliberal guy, I was like, oh, I fucking hate this. This guy's just French Trudeau. And then he actually gets elected, and he's like, I'm actually immortal. I'm like, this guy rules.
No, he does rule because that's the thing behind the veil of that neoliberal pose of rationality and thoughtfulness and clear-headedness is that, you know, when the world refuses to conform to your dictates, you basically go insane and you turn into Emmanuel Macron.
That's what all of these people are, though. They're all, and this is we're veering into a different nerd territory here, but this is the Galadriel thing where they're like, okay, it's very dangerous amount of power, but I personally should be able to wield it. And that's the lib mindset. But I do actually want to talk about this tweet I sent both of you, where Charlie Kirk, who is just a sentient turd, responded to Ted Lieu, who's a...
The tweeting congressman.
Yeah. he loves to post.
Couldn't you imagine? I wish we had a better tweeting congressman.
I know.
If it was Prospector.
Exactly. Vote Drill.
Ted Lieu said that, like, the use of force by real Donald Trump against Syria is unconstitutional. This is not self-defense and... nothing covers it. The use of chemical weapons is horrific, but our Constitution is not blah, 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 blah. And Charlie Kirk responded to it, you're a moron. War Powers Act of 1973 clearly allows a president 60 days to use military force until having to go in front of Congress. Every president has used his authority constitutionally the last 4 years, including Obama, where you stayed selectively silent. Now, again, I don't want to be like, well, where were you then? But also, this does point out a real problem with trying to rely on proceduralism, and we need to start making moral arguments against war, because the procedural arguments against war don't work because the entire rule book is set up to foster war.
No, the entire international law argument, the entire you didn't ask Congress permission, it just
Yeah, it's just like, well,
spinning
you
your
didn't,
wheels.
Yeah, you didn't have a cover page on your report, so you get an F on your midterm. Like, no, first of all, it doesn't work like that. Second of all, you can do everything by the book and wreak absolute havoc all over the world.
It reminds me of those videos libertarians make where it's like, now, if you ever get pulled over by a cop, if you say,
yes, exactly.
Are you being detained?
Exactly. They have this delusional idea, and this is the problem with like these nice libs and these nice Dems who are just now discovering that, like, hey, maybe war is kind of horrific, is that they think that, like, look, if I play by all the rules, I'm going to get you, and you're not going to be able to, I'll just follow the rules harder than anyone else. And it's like, you can't goody-goody your way out of this, you little shit.
I think an interesting point about the rules, at least as it pertains to the U.S. executive branch and war-making, is, like, the broader structural point here is that the presidency has way too much power in these matters, and it would be better if we had an executive branch that basically withered away and was a ceremonial position.
Or a country that withered away, honestly.
But the point is, like, the presidency is basically the office of imperial manager. It's basically understood that foreign policy is too important to be kept in the realm of domestic politics, which is, you know, that's just something that people vote on. You know, our real power, like, what's really important is foreign policy and our military and how we govern the world. And it's basically everything we do isn't popular, even among the right and left. But what we need is a presidency, it doesn't matter what party they are in or who voted for them or what, that'll toe the line as imperial manager and carry out this foreign policy that is, as I've mentioned, completely untethered from our threadbare constitution or any kind of democratic input from the people.
And I mean, burn the constitution whatsoever, but, you know, there has been multiple kind of polls on this, and the NGO class and the media class in terms of foreign policy are right-wing, more right-wing on average than the average bumblefuck American in the middle of nowhere. There's this idea is that there are these, like, crude, uneducated meatheads that are always wanting to go to war. That's absolutely not true. Americans every day are being subjected to war propaganda constantly, and yet they're still less right-wing in terms of war than, like, fucking Samantha Power.
Yeah. In fact, because of that, there's been a slight right-wing blowback against Trump. From Alex Jones got very, very
crying.
Even real men cry sometimes. Even real men show some emotion.
The Assadist alt-right people are very unhappy about all of this. But I just wanted to share one message from a diehard Trump supporter, Bill Mitchell. For any of these people
staying
who are
strong,
any of these people who are doubting their big wet boy just because he went back on his explicit promise to be less imperial and less aggressive in foreign policy and got us more involved in a war that he said he wouldn't and tweeted about over and over again.
Oh, can I just say before this, when Alex Jones was crying, he said, "Trump betrayed us. Is no one in this world pure?" And to say that about Donald Trump,
just our pure boy.
I thought Donald Trump was pure.
Until that very moment, I thought this glistening,
they thought he was
sybaritic monster was my pure boy. But to Alex Jones and the rest, Bill Mitchell says, when you only back your president when he does 100% of what you want, you're not a supporter. You're a user.
Holy shit. Oh, Bill isn't.
Can we lead out with Tammy Wynette's Stand By Your Man?
Let's do it.
Oh, dude, that is the rebuke. That is the 2018 rebuke of fake friends. I'm sick of people manipulating President Donald Trump.
But that's the end result, where politics is basically your Instagram feed. You know, he's just another thought that you follow, and people need to get off his back. He's doing the best he can.
You're a user. That's amazing.
This is what happens when your politics are formed by, like, highly hostile interpersonal Facebook memes.
You want a politician to do things that you want? That dude, homie, what? That's not a friend.
So we'll see how this all turns out. We'll be paying attention to it. In case you needed someone like me to tell you it. The only sane position here is 100% opposition to military intervention in Syria.
Existing and escalating and continuing.
Yeah, and anyone who tries to make the argument seem like it's really more complicated than that is selling you a bill of shit.
Today we are here with Dan Finn, who is deputy editor of the New Left Review, and he recently has something in Jacobin called Corbyn Under Fire. I don't know who all has been following this, but if you caught that fantastic Daily Mail headline, I believe it was, they held a beetroot in the air and shouted, fuck capitalism. Now, there are a lot of differences and similarities between like UK media and American media. Size is a huge one, but they're both very insular. They're both very sort of like close to power, that kind of thing. But I have to know, does the Daily Mail not have one Jew in their room to tell them that it is a horseradish for the Seder plate and not a beetroot? Yes, oh Felix, they totally did that.
What? Yeah. Oh, you know, the typical Seder, you drip your beetroot in mayo. You hide the pita, the famous unleavened bread.
So we're talking, of course, about Jeremy Corbyn was invited to a Seder with a left group that is very sort of tongue-in-cheek named Judas, spelled Jew and then Dus. And the sort of both the right wing and the sort of right of labor has been running with it and been terrified about this, or at least feigning terror over so-called anti-Semitism in the Labor Party. Dan, can you tell us about this? Why is Jeremy Corbyn leading pogroms?
Well, I mean, the Judas story was one of the most farcical elements of the whole thing. Some of the people who were giving out about it obviously knew so much about the subject that they spelt, instead of Cedar, it was Sieber. and of course, the outrage about beetroots and all that sort of thing. It did have a positive side to it that this hitherto very obscure, marginal left-wing Jewish group in Britain all of a sudden became nationally famous, and they managed to overtake on Twitter for the number of followers the Board of Deputies, which is the, I would say, the very conservative establishment voice of the British Jewish community. And that was one of the reasons why Judas was set up in the first place, that they wanted to challenge that monopoly of, you know, Jewish political expression from people who are very right-wing, support the Conservative Party, don't just support Israel, but support Netanyahu, people who send messages of congratulations to Donald Trump without mentioning any of the dog whistles about George Soros in his campaign. And those were the very people who have been pointing the finger at Jeremy Corbyn. But along with the Daily Mail and the Telegraph and the Times and all these very right-wing newspapers that have a history of openly flirting with racism or just getting down and dancing with racism, including anti-Semitism. With Corbyn, I think, and the Labour Party, I think the main thing is to focus on the big picture, because people often get caught up talking about individual cases. But the big picture, there's a narrative that's being put about by large parts of the British media, not just the right-wing press, the liberal press as well, the BBC, which say the Labour Party is riddled with anti-Semitism from top to bottom. It's a cold house for Jews. That was a phrase used by columnists for the Guardian newspaper, liberal newspaper. It's a party for the many, not the Jew, which is...
That's fantastic. That sounds like a title slogan that we would have come up with.
And that whole narrative is just completely false and defamatory. And when people are asked about this, you know, the question that's always put to Labour Party members, whether they're senior politicians or ordinary members, they always say, do you accept that Labour has a problem with anti-Semitism? And that's a trick question, because nobody's going to say no. Because if you have a single member with anti-Semitic views, that's a problem.
How many people are in the Labour Party right now?
Over 500,000.
So there's going to be one or two anti-Semites.
Yeah, it's about 1% of the population, the adult population in Britain, is now a member of the Labour Party since this big surge in membership post-Corbyn. And the cases that have been brought to light, I mean, there certainly have been cases of Labour Party members making anti-Semitic comments on social media especially, but they're counted in the tens and the 20s, not in the thousands and the tens of thousands. So you're not talking about 10%, you're not talking about 1%, you're not even talking about 0.1 of 1%. And of course, you know, that doesn't mean you should say that's fine. There's less anti-Semitism in the Labour Party than there is in British society as a whole. Of course, the left-wing party should be trying harder They should be going the extra mile. They should be doing everything they can to root out any kind of bigotry. And that's perfectly fair to say to Labour that they should do that. But that's not the argument that's been put there. The argument has not been that some Labour Party members have made anti-Semitic comments, or even that the party's own disciplinary structures aren't up to scratch, or that the leadership has been guilty of some failings. If that had been the main line come from the media, that wouldn't have been a smear, that wouldn't have been a lie. And I think the majority of people, including Corbyn himself, would have responded to that in good faith. They would have seen it as a constructive engagement. But instead, they've been bombarded with this hysterical stuff, absolutely hysterical, giving the impression that the Labour Party has the kind of atmosphere of a Munich beer hall in the 1930s. And some of it is just completely hallucinatory. Just to give you one example of a story that was published in the New York Times by Harold Jacobson, who's best known as a novelist, but he's a very strong detractor of Corbyn and the Labour Party as well. He wrote an article after the Labour Party conference last year in which he claimed there was a motion on the conference floor proposed to question the truth of the Holocaust. Now, that just never happened. It was completely made up. It's not even an exaggeration of something that happened on the conference floor. He just made it up. And I would have thought the New York Times had fact checkers, but they allowed that to get through. And people must have read that and thought, well, it's in the Times. That has to have been true. If it was true, it would be a really shocking thing to read about, but it just didn't happen. There's plenty of examples of that. There's all kinds of innuendo where people are accused of anti-Semitism just because of things they said about Israel. I'm sure you're familiar with some of these arguments where it's not quite said that to criticize Israel is anti-Semitic, but people are accused of singling out Israel. They have an unhealthy interest in Israel. Why don't you talk about Syria? Why don't you talk about other countries? In fact, the people who protest against Israel and the Labour Party also protest against countries like Turkey, Saudi Arabia, involved in major human rights violations and aggressive wars and oppressing people like the Kurds and waging war in Yemen. They're the very same people who are critical of Netanyahu's government, but they're still accused of being, you know, obsessively focused on Israel. And there's only one real explanation for why they should be so obsessively focused on Israel.
Yeah. One thing I forgot to mention, too, about that story, he was invited to speak. And Judas is like, I had never heard of them before, and I have been sort of reading pretty heavily about the, you know, accusations of anti-Semitism against the Labour Party for a while now. But he was invited, and he brought the horseradish from his garden because he is an angel.
That he really is the best type of Seder guest.
Yeah.
Sometimes you do bring...
What, a goy?
Well, sometimes you bring goys to a Seder, and it's nice because it interrupts the traditional, like, sniping at each other about redoing some tax assessment or whatever.
Right.
Yeah, and Corbyn is the idealized goy that you bring to your Seder.
He is. He's the platonic goy. Wait, he's the absolute goy.
Just as I mean, the thing, one of the things about it was that it wasn't even meant to be a political intervention by Corbyn. You know, he was just, these guys were his friends because the people behind Judas, they're veteran left wing activists in London, a lot of them in North London. And they've been friends with him for decades. So they invited him along, not because he was the leader of the Labour Party. You know, they would have invited him along when he was just an ordinary Labour MP. And he went along not out of some political calculation, but just because he wanted to go along to stay with his friends. I mean, one of the most surreal stories that, you know, the Mail got 2 or 3 days of outrage out of it. And one of the most surreal stories they had was exposing the shocking fact that Corbyn had shared a table with a man called David Rosenberg. And I think this is the first time David Rosenberg ever made it into the national press. But anyone who's been around the left in London would know him pretty well. He's a great guy. You know, he's a historian who does walking tours about the Jewish history of the East End of London. He helped organize the march for the 80th anniversary of the Cable Street demonstration in the 1930s, which is when the Jewish community in the East End came out to confront Britain's fascist movement along with non-Jewish left-wing activists and beat them off the streets. You know, the Mail managed to get a whole story about the shocking fact that Corbyn was sitting down to talk with this man, David Rosenberg, without mentioning the fact that he was Jewish. And they quoted out of context some things that David Rosenberg had said, arguing that, as I would say, the whole narrative around Labour anti-Semitism was completely exaggerated and largely manufactured. And he was presented by the Mail as some kind of sinister apologist for anti-Semitism when, you know, anyone who knows David...
His name is David Rosenberg.
Well, there's that. But, you know, he's also been someone who's been very careful to speak out whenever he does see anti-Semitic attitudes creeping into left-wing circles or people picking up certain tropes that they don't even understand fully, conspiracy stuff, you know, stuff about the Rothschilds or George Soros or that kind of trash. He's always been very clear in speaking out against that. And yet he's, you know, travestied by the Daily Mail as some kind of, you know, Gauleiter figure.
Right. Well, I think, too, you saw Judas get smeared as these kind of self-loathing Jews, too, because they're like in the Haggadah or whatever. They do the Palestine supplement to the Passover prayer. That's, you know, kind of like it's a very common thing for left-wing Palestinian sympathist Jews to do. But I think people went one of two ways with it. Like, oh, look, he's doing this cynical PR move. Or they said, oh, look, he found the most anti-Israel Jews he possibly could.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and people managed to hold those two views simultaneously as well.
Right, right. Very convenient. But I guess one of the things, it's kind of hard to trace the origins of this story. And you saw, I mean, it's a common tactic for sort of liberals, and we see it a lot as sort of this weaponization of identity politics to take down left-wing figures. We saw during the campaign attempts to sort of smear the momentum in the Corbyn campaign as sexist or whatever, and it didn't really take hold. But this actually has sort of a lot more juice behind it. I mean, there's a lot more ink being spilled over this bugaboo of anti-Semitism in the Labour Party. Where did that come from and why is it still going?
I think some of it involves tactics that have been imported from the US, because I'm sure you know about the way that Palestine solidarity activists in a lot of American university campuses are targeted by pro-Israel activists. Rather than just engaging with them politically and trying to refute their arguments, they accused them of threatening Jewish students, of having been made anti-Semitic remarks and that sort of thing. And then the university investigates these complaints. They're found to be groundless. But in the meantime, people have had to expend a lot of energy defending themselves against these false allegations. And they've had a pretty traumatic experience. And very often they've had their names spread throughout the internet with these accusations. That was actually the beginning of the controversy about the Labour Party. Also involved a Labour Party society in Oxford University, where they were accused of making all kinds of ugly anti-Semitic remarks. You could tell right from the start that there was something iffy about it, because the guy who made these allegations, the main thing he seemed to be concerned about was that Labour had endorsed the Israel Apartheid Week and taking part in some of the events and some of the protests. Subsequently, it was investigated and found to be, both by the university and by Labour Party's disciplinary bodies, it was found to be without any basis. But in the meantime, you know, the thing had been allowed to snowball. I think one of the things that does give it legs is the fact that you have organisations, like I mentioned earlier, the Board of Deputies of British Jews and various other organisations like that, which claim to be representative of the entire Jewish community in Britain. And they do represent a certain section of Jewish opinion in Britain, but definitely not the whole community. For example, Jonathan Arkush, the guy who's the president of the Board of Deputies, as I mentioned earlier, he rushed out a statement of congratulations to Donald Trump after he won the presidency of the US. When Theresa May lost her election lost her parliamentary majority in the election last year, he rushed out a statement bemoaning this. He welcomed it when she formed an alliance with the Democratic Unionist Party, far right party from Northern Ireland. He supports everything that Netanyahu's government does to the hilt. So he represents a very, very right wing political agenda. It's not just about Israel. Of course, he's very pro-Israel and pro-Netanyahu, but it's a wider agenda as well. And of course, it's going to be completely unsympathetic to a left-wing leadership of the Labour Party. So there's a kind of feedback loop there where particular people who claim to be representative of the Jewish community in Britain, but aren't necessarily so, they make these allegations, and then it's signal boosted by the Tory press, because obviously they want to throw as much mud as they can at the Labour Party. And it goes back and forth like that. And that's been the main source of the controversy. That's why people haven't stepped back and said, hang on, what is the actual connection between the facts of the matter here and the narrative that we've been pushing? Because if you ever did that, you'd say 90% of the hype and the hysteria around this is just groundless. What you have is a problem which is real to the extent that you still have some people in the Labour Party with and on the wider left with anti-Semitic views, and you have to do something about that. But this idea of a party where it's systemic, where it comes from the leadership down, the whole party is rotten with anti-Semitic prejudice from top to bottom, it's just not true, and the facts don't bear it out. And anyone who's tried to do any kind of serious empirical investigation has had to say the facts don't bear that out.
I wonder if there's any anti-Semitism in the Northern Irish Unionist Party. I think maybe...
Actually, they love Israel because they're big fans of settler colonialism and apartheid.
Yeah, they have like a Marvel Infinity War mural of every settler colonial state.
No, they do.
Yeah,
they do.
In the really North, really they love... Yeah,
yeah,
they love
you'll go to the club and they'll have the Union Jack, the Israeli flag, and then the apartheid-era South African and Rhodesian flags up there.
Well, I mean...
It's lit, fam.
Yeah. I think it's pretty clear that, you know, you can be as personally anti-Semitic as possible, provided that you support Israel.
Yes, I can. Oh, wait, okay. The second part. Oh.
No, but Dan, I wanted to ask you, like, it seems pretty obvious what's going on, like what you said, with, like, the Telegraph or the Mail or the right-wing press in Britain, which will do, you know, will pick any stone or club at hand to hit Jeremy Corbyn with, and anti-Semitism is, you know, the easiest one they have now. But what do you think is going on with, like, the traditionally, like, liberal press in Britain, like The Guardian and members of the Labour Party who are also unhappy with Corbyn, and are also sort of flirting with this idea that, hey, you know, we need to get serious about this, or we need to talk about this, or make an issue out of it?
Yeah, I mean, you've got people, like, for example, in the Labour Party, there's a significant group of Labour MPs who are signed up to the Friends of Israel group. But that's just part of a wider political agenda that they're signed up to in terms of foreign policy. The very same MPs are very, very keen on Saudi Arabia. They used to be very keen on Alvaro Uribe in Colombia. They pal around with Erdogan. You know, there's one particular Labour MP who's been extremely vocal on the subject of anti-Semitism, and was outraged by Corbyn attending this Judas event. He went to Turkey on a junket paid for by a relative of Erdogan, and since then has come back parroting the line of the Turkish government on everything to do with Kurdish rights, clampdown on dissent, and so on. You know, he's known as the... the only AKP MP in Britain. He's also extremely vociferous in support of Saudi Arabia. I mean, that's one of the reasons why people are so hostile to Corbyn, because it's not just about his opinions of Israel. You know, his position on Israel and the Palestinians, on paper, it's not especially radical. You know, he's in favor of a two-state solution, as European governments are also meant to be. The trouble with Corbyn is that people think he actually means it, and he doesn't present the conflict as being between two equal sides. You know, he talks about the oppression of the Palestinians. He talks about bringing real pressure to bear on the Israeli government.
He was also very critical of May selling weapons to Saudi Arabia as well.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the issues that he's had trouble with some of his MPs over, that about a year and a half ago, they brought forward a motion, the Labour Party brought forward a motion to have an investigation into the Saudi war in Yemen, and in the meantime, arms sales would be frozen. And this is something that, you know, Britain is up to their necks in. It's not just a question of selling the weapons that are being used in Yemen. They've got British military personnel in the Saudi control room helping them to call in airstrikes, that level of cooperation. And about 50 Labour MPs refused to support that motion. And some of them were a bit slinky and shameful about it. You know, they just didn't show up for the vote. They pretended that they were sick, that sort of thing. But some of them were extremely proud. They got up in Parliament and voted against this motion and explained that they fully supported the war in Yemen. Completely brushed aside all of the evidence about the humanitarian disaster that it was causing and all the civilians that were being killed. So, you know, these guys, they're in the tradition of Tony Blair, which, you know, if you've followed Tony Blair's career since he stepped down as prime minister, he's set himself up as a sort of PR man for hire for the war criminals of the world. He goes around from Kazakhstan, Nazarbayev, Paul Kagame in Rwanda, first Mubarak and now Sisi in Egypt, and the Saudi royals above all. The last week or so, he's been ardently calling for war in Syria to overthrow Assad, and some people have unkindly suggested that it's like a protection racket because Assad hasn't paid for his services. He wants to send a message out to any dictator who doesn't pay for Tony Blair. This is what's going to happen to you. But, you know, that's the tradition that these people were reared in. You know, they don't even question, I suppose, that the alliance with Saudi Arabia and Britain is one of those unquestionable totems of the foreign policy establishment. And they really hate Corbyn because he just asked the question, why? Why are we aligned with these guys? Why is it okay to be aligned with these guys but not with Iran, for example? Why is Iran beyond the pale but Saudi Arabia is a perfectly respectable force? You know, a couple of months ago, the up-and-coming, the real power in Saudi Arabia, the young royal there, he came to London on a visit, and it was extraordinary being around here. There were, like, billboards in the street, full-page ads in newspapers to welcome, this kind of thing. It was the sort of thing you'd expect in North Korea, really. But that's the extent of the loyalty to Saudi Arabia. And then with the, you know, the Guardian newspaper has been bitterly hostile to Corbyn from the very start, to a ludicrous extent, to a point where, you know, they've really alienated a large part of their readership. I'm not even talking about people who'd be hardcore left-wingers, but just people who were in some way sympathetic to what the Labour Party has stood for under Corbyn. And some of them, along with some of the Labour MPs, they were quietened down for a bit by the election result last year because it went much better than anyone expected. It went much better than they had hoped. They were hoping for Labour to do very badly, and this would set the stage to oust Corbyn. When he got 40% of the vote, they were completely startled, and that put them back for a while. But it's these issues around Israel, Saudi Arabia, that they started to find their voice on. The first example, actually, the first time they popped their heads above the parapet after the election was over Venezuela last summer, where all of a sudden a group of Labour MPs who'd never asked a question about Venezuela or said anything to do with anything in Latin America in their whole careers set up an all-party group, parliamentary group on Venezuela to demand that Corbyn denounce Maduro and support an opposition and all this kind of stuff. You know, that's the kind of attitude they have. Their first loyalty in politics is to NATO, it's to Washington, and all the stuff that goes with that, whether it's Netanyahu, whether it's Erdogan, whether it's the Saudi royals, the war in Yemen. They're signed up to that whole agenda, and everything else comes behind it.
That MP you talked about, is it John Woodcock?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, Woodcock, he was actually in a video by Bosphorus Global, which is a weird Turkish think tank that has some, like, weird links to ISIS oil. And they were, like, bragging, like, look who just stood up for us. Shout out to our homie John Woodcock. But going back a little bit to Corbyn's stance on Israel and Palestine and a lot of these other things, I feel like the sort of center-right NatSec press in either our country or the UK, they'll go harder against a guy like that who will just take a sort of what is generally, if you actually look at it on paper, like a very moderate stance. Like, you know, this is an occupation in Gaza. We shouldn't support this, but not like, let's nuke Tel Aviv.
Right.
You know, they'll go harder on that because they're more afraid of.
We're middle of the road here. We just want to give Palestinians a nuke. Just right. Like one nuke.
Right.
But they need a deterrent, okay? Right.
But they go harder on that, I feel, in the same reason that they sort of went hard on the Iran deal. And I think it scares them to see the window in their world of respectable politics pushed just a little bit more than anything else existing in the world. They know there are more extreme positions out there and there are people more in line with those positions, but it is more terrifying to them, someone like, you remember the stuff about Keith Ellison?
Oh, yeah.
Keith Ellison has a even more, like, to the right stance on a lot of this stuff than Corbyn, because in America, we don't even really have that much of an anti-war movement.
We basically haven't had one since Obama.
But he just says the word Palestine, and it's just fucking nuclear freak out because these institutions rely on, they're not even being a presence of a reasonable, moderate counterweight. You know, go back a little bit. What got Phil Donahue fired from MSNBC? The way that he opposed the Iraq War. Mm-hmm. They're more interested in even just the sort of like New Deal liberal type war opposition. They're more terrified of that than anything.
Yeah.
Even if you actually look at it on paper, it's like this is really, you know, half the people are probably calling this guy a cuck because he's saying don't nuke Tel Aviv. But that's still too much. The position, the presence of that position is acceptable, is seen as an existential threat to them. Just like, you know, having not completely embargoing Iran is seen as legitimizing them. Like it wasn't already a, you know, like it wasn't already a country, because they're anything that threatens their general order is the most terrifying thing in the world. They rely on setting the narrative every time.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that media pundits especially don't like about Corbyn is that they know full well he does speak for a pretty big section of British public opinion. And the classic example of that was during the general election campaign last year. There was a terrorist attack in Manchester, you know, really horrible attack where a suicide bomber blew himself up at a pop concert, killed a load of kids. Really horrendous. And Jeremy Corbyn, his first public reaction to that was to make a speech in which he said, of course, nothing could ever justify this and the responsibility lies with the terrorists. But we have to look at whether the war on terror has made things worse or made things better. And the overwhelming evidence is it's made things worse. It's aggravated instability. It's created conditions for groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIS to grow and spread. And the whole experience of the war on terror since 9/11 has been a failure. And when this was being flagged up the previous night, I remember all the wise political commentators saying, this is suicide. This guy is going to blow their whole election campaign. They're going to drop 10 points in the polls. People like strong leaders. They like someone who are tough on security. This is not the time to be making these kind of comments. And then the next day, he made this speech. He was very good at it. He was very cogent, articulate, very moderate. And a poll was done that day, and the majority of people agreed with him. Even conservative voters agreed with him because it's so blindingly obvious.
Yeah, you know? I remember that. I remember being like, oh, shit, this is going to blow the election for him because people are, you know, people act rashly when they're scared. And like, lo and behold, it just didn't happen. Everyone somehow kept a cool head. It was like really, it was really heartening, actually. Well,
people freaked out because no one had ever really in our modern age had really ever did what Corbyn did there. And it was one of the most amazing things I have seen in electoral politics in my lifetime.
Yeah, and people, they really surprised me. It was, like, really encouraging. I had a little, oh, humankind are not monsters.
I have to say, I remember the night before when it had been flagged up that he was making a speech, I went to bed with this kind of giddy sense of anticipation, thinking, oh, he's actually going for this, you know? Even if it goes horribly wrong, at least they didn't chicken out. And then the next day when you were watching the coverage all day and finally you saw this opinion poll, it was like watching a football match and cheering, you know? But you know, that's the kind of thought that's not meant to be spoken in public because they know it makes sense. So you have to just declare it verboten. You can't even say these things in public. I think it appealed to people because there's obviously been a learning curve over the last 15, 16 years. You know, this is not the day after 9/11. People can remember what has happened before when there were terrorist attacks in Britain or in the US or in France and what the reaction was and the military reaction going off, bombing a country, invading a country, whether it made people safe or not. And they can see the results. So, you know, people have been watching for the last 15 or 16 years, even though it seems pretty clear, certainly reading all the commentary from the prospect of bombing Syria the last week, the people who were paid to write about politics and about foreign policy in the British media haven't learned a thing. There's a whole generation of pundits who should have been cleared out and pensioned off after they got things so wrong about Iraq, and they were allowed to carry on in their positions, and they've learned absolutely nothing. But the great British public aren't quite as blind as them. And this, you know, this kind of awareness, understanding, it's not just restricted to people on the left. I would say there's a pretty wide range of people in the centre and even on the right who don't agree with Corbyn about taxation or, you know, public ownership or questions like that, and think he's a bit of a bit of a loony lefty, but when he says these things, they just nod their head and say, well, that's just common sense, isn't it?
Dan, just to like wrap things up here, from an outsider's perspective, of course, you know, what you've described is Jeremy Corbyn is being knocked as an anti-Semite for attending a Passover Seder with Jewish people. And, you know, it seems ludicrous, but are you worried that Amber alluded to earlier, like the original line of attack when the election was happening was Labour and Jeremy Corbyn in particular and Momentum, they have a problem with women. And that didn't really stick. Are you worried that this anti-Semitism line has more purchase or more staying power than the idea that that they have a problem with women or that they're mean to women?
I certainly think it has more purchase, but I think the real danger of the stuff that's been talked about so much in the last couple of months, because it wasn't just the anti-Semitism controversy, because before that, you had this 2 or 3 weeks dedicated to the idea that Corbyn was a Czechoslovakian spy.
Which oh, yeah.
That ruled. That didn't stick at all because people were like, cool.
It should have died a death in 24 hours. I mean, the guy who was making this claim also claimed that he had organized the Live Aid conference.
Wait, Geldof is accusing him of this?
Well, I like the idea of Geldof being an Eastern Bloc spy. But that, you know, that was allowed to run for a couple of weeks. And then there was a story where a former Russian agent was poisoned in Britain and Corbyn was accused of being unpatriotic. Not because he said this definitely wasn't the Russian government, just because he said, let's not rush to judgment here. Let's look at the evidence. Let's look before we leap, that sort of thing. So this has been ongoing since, I would say, the start of February. And it means that while Labour is tied up with these stories, it doesn't appear to have had much of an impact on their polling figures. You know, their polling figures have held up during that whole period. But it means they don't get the chance to talk about their actual policies, their manifesto. They're going into the local elections. They're going to be held here in a few weeks' time. And Labour has all kinds of, you know, ideas for how to change the economy. They're not especially radical. You know, it's not like they have some sort of revolutionary anti-capitalist program, but they've got a good, robust social democratic program. And whenever people are asked about the policies that they put forward, they're very popular and they resonate with people and they stand out against the Conservative Party, which is increasingly discredited on every aspect of their economic record and is left defending policies that are deeply unpopular. But the longer they spend having to beat back these allegations, and even if the controversy itself doesn't stick in the long run, that's time wasted. And I think a large point of these manufactured controversies is to tie them up in that and prevent them from looking outward and prevent them from using their energies to actually win over new people.
Dan Finn, thank you so much for joining us.
And
thanks.
And congratulations on being, I think, the second Irish person we have allowed to be on the show.
Wait. He's Irish?
Yeah.
We did not discuss this.
Yes. Get rid of this.
Cut him off.
Sorry, you're never coming back. We are here with Eric Blanc. He has been covering all of the teacher strikes for Jacobin. You should go back and read everything he's written so far. We talked a little bit about West Virginia when we interviewed a teacher a few episodes ago. Now things are going off in Oklahoma. Eric, can you tell us about what's going on?
Yeah. So Oklahoma has been on strike basically for the last 2 weeks. Very similar issues to West Virginia, for those who followed West Virginia. Catastrophic conditions in the schools due to years of austerity by both Republicans and Democrats. And teachers and staff reached a breaking point. In response to West Virginia, Oklahoma teachers in particular rose up maybe a little early, very excited about trying to win some semblance of public education, which has been really decimated. And for the last 2 weeks have organized a really massive, unprecedented strike. What happens now remains to be seen. But I think the big story is that despite the lack of organization, despite the lack of labor traditions, you've still seen that in a red state, quote unquote, working class folks are really sick of what's going on. And so it's very similar to West Virginia in that sense.
So West Virginia, I think, coordinated three different unions. Who are the sort of players in Oklahoma right now?
Yeah, the thing to keep in mind is the level of organization in Oklahoma is significantly lower as far as both trade union organization and what we could call like militant minority, as far as radical workers who've been organizing, who have more of a class struggle perspective. So both of these forces are significantly weaker, and it's a major factor in the way that the strike has played out. And so you have one major union, which is the Oklahoma Education Association. And like a lot of other unions, most other unions, it's focused on lobbying the Democrats in a really ineffective way. Mm-hmm. And that has led to an impasse, which is one of the reasons why we see these wildcat strikes both in West Virginia and in Oklahoma, because the old strategy didn't work. The going and pleading with the legislators didn't work. Voting in the Democrats didn't work, because when you did vote them in, they kept on cutting taxes just like the Republicans. Right. So what that means then is a lot of people just tune out, right? Sure. If you don't see any alternative, you're going to tune out. And the mobilization from below, therefore, has taken a really... what people would call spontaneous, but really what that means is people organize without any institutional framework to cohere their mobilization. And the dynamic then is that there was a Facebook page, like in West Virginia, that created some vehicle for the rank-and-file teachers who wanted to organize a strike on the model of West Virginia. And so the two main forces, I think, if you want to think about the overall contour of the movement, are the union and the rank and file, largely organized through two Facebook pages. But unfortunately, the difference with West Virginia is that it's remained up until very recently almost all on Facebook. The type of organization building that went into the previous strike, where there was really months of build-up actions, a lot of really important steps to build organizational capacity, that type of dynamic didn't really happen in Oklahoma. So you had a strike called with very little of a organizational base to push it forward. And so it's a little bit more hollowed out of a movement.
We're recording this on a Sunday right now. I just want to, like, in terms of the time frame, like, what is the status of the strike as of now? And this idea that it may persist into a wildcat strike on come Monday, come tomorrow, when the show probably comes out?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. The current situation looks pretty bleak. The union leadership, after more or less 2 weeks of fighting, to their credit, threw in the towel without consulting the membership. Last Thursday, said, it's over, we're going back. Didn't put up a vote to the ranks and pivoted to saying, we're going to get them in November. We'll remember in November, which basically means trying to elect Democrats in November. Even if that was your strategy, which I think is a dumb, counterproductive strategy, even if that were the case, you would still want to win the strike. It doesn't actually make sense to end your strike. And the support is there. This is the remarkable and really sort of tragic dynamic of the strike, is that 72% of the population supports the strikers winning all of their demands. And so the current situation is that there's widespread anger because teachers didn't want to go back. They were fighting for funding. This is the crucial thing, is that they had won a pay increase before the strike even began. They won a $6,000 pay increase, which is not chump change. It shows that organizing for a strike can win real way more than they'd won ever before. So what they've been striking for these last 2 weeks is an increase in funding for public education, because, as I mentioned, the schools have been decimated. They haven't won that. So people wanted to stay out. The union leadership threw in the towel. And unfortunately, it's unclear whether there will be a wildcat on Monday. There's a lot of anger. People have, over the weekend, have tried to cobble together via Facebook, via some in-person meetings, calls for people to stay out on Monday. My guess is there will be probably hundreds, if not thousands, of people at the Capitol on Monday. Whether that's enough to really turn around the momentum, which has largely dissipated, is an open question.
Well, I mean, I don't know why you're poo-pooing the electoral strategy. It worked great in Wisconsin. that's why now the number one place kids get educated there is Chuck E. Cheese. But what is the thing that made the leadership essentially blink in the face of popular support and continued enthusiasm among the actual teachers?
Well, we should keep in mind that the leadership was pushed much further than they wanted to go. This is not a leadership that is, you know, waging for a strike. They saw what was happening from below, and they realized that the ranks would go beyond them if they didn't get on board. And so this, in some ways, was a convenient excuse. The excuse was that the Republicans, after 2 weeks, hadn't given anything. So their explanation is, we tried, the pressure we had wasn't sufficient, so we have to go back. Now, there's two ways of looking at that. You could say, yeah, that's a logical conclusion. They tried, and now we have to pivot. But what people from below argued, I think correctly, is no, there's an alternative, which is you have to deepen the mobilization. There's all sorts of possibilities to deepen the mobilization. For instance, what about state workers? The state workers have been screwed just as bad. And there was push for state workers initially to come out on the first day of a walkout. So that could have happened, and there was calls for that. They didn't do that. There was also the case that if you keep the strike going, the pressure would mount on the politicians to cave. Really what this was is an endurance test. Who's going to stay out longer? Unfortunately, the leadership threw in the towel really before the ranks were ready, and I think before the struggle was over.
What's interesting to me is that they got the pay raises, and where, you know, the union leadership threw in the towel was on improving the schools. Usually, people only like teachers when they are, you know, seemingly these selfless people who are willing to work for absolutely nothing, but they are, they're sympathetic when they're saying we need these conditions to teach children. This is sort of they walked away from the table earlier, at least the leadership did, but it is interesting that they got a big pay raise. I mean, was the pay just so low that like public opinion was just like had to concede that no one could survive off that?
Yeah, the conditions for teachers in particular were so bad that even before the strike, there was talk amongst Republicans that we have to give them something. The obstacle has been that you have to have a 75% supermajority in Oklahoma to pass any tax increases. And so despite some of the moderate Republicans saying, yeah, we should give some pay raises for years now, there had been an institutional block. This strike was sufficient. The threat of a strike was sufficient to have forced everybody to grant the teacher pay raise. But even then, it barely makes up for the years of no pay increases whatsoever. And it doesn't do anything to the conditions in the schools. So the pay raise is great. We shouldn't poo-poo that. Like, that's a real thing.
Of course, yeah.
And people feel good about that. But what do you do if you still have no functioning chairs in your class? You still have these textbooks. People might have seen these pictures of over a decade before. You have ceilings falling in. So in those conditions, it's understandable why teachers would want to stay out and why students would want their teachers to stay out for their own conditions as well.
Yeah.
On the issue, though, of concessions and at least the pay raise, which, as you mentioned, shows that a strike can accomplish way more than not striking would have. But by comparison to West Virginia, when we talked to that teacher, he said that their main thing was they wanted the pay raise to be funded by a new tax. And what ended up happening is the pay raise ended up being funded by cuts elsewhere, which is sort of a Pyrrhic victory, because if your raise is getting paid for with cuts to social services and things that people would otherwise be sympathetic to you rely on, they begin to blame you for the first place, so that they weren't able to get a new revenue source to pay for their increased pay. How did that shake out in Oklahoma?
Right. The first thing I would say, in West Virginia, it's a little bit more complicated. There was a surplus of a lot of the funds that paid for the raise. It wasn't that it came out of deep new cuts.
Okay.
So that got pushed by the Republicans as a way also to spin it when they conceded. And the actual amount of cuts was relatively minor. So that's important, which isn't to say that the issue you raised is secondary. It's actually crucial, because clearly there has to be increased revenue both in West Virginia and in Oklahoma if the teachers winning anything is not going to come on the backs of other poor people. So that issue is very central still in West Virginia. In Oklahoma, the dynamic is as follows. The cuts to basically the tax breaks, upwards of, the estimation is that it's $1.5 billion a year are lost from the tax breaks that have been passed just in the last 10 years. That is a huge astronomical amount of money. That plus the really low level of taxation that goes on oil and natural gas. These are the conditions in which there's a quote-unquote funding crisis. People aren't dumb. People see that. If you looked at the signs that people from below, less so the union leadership, but the signs that people had, they said money for schools, not for oil companies, right? People know that the funds are there. Students know that the funds are there. It's a question of putting the pressure on the corporations and the politicians that are bought by them to concede those. So the demand has been, for instance, in Oklahoma, you have to pay for the schools, for instance, by raising what's called the GPT, which is it's basically a tax on extracting oil and natural gas. Right now, up until just this last concession that was made to pass the pay raise, it was at 2%, which even just 3 years ago, it was at 7%. So the big concession that now the Republicans gave to pay for this raise only brought it up to 5%. It didn't even go to where it was just a few years ago. People are talking if they were to tax oil and natural gas on a commensurate level to Texas or Alaska, they would have literally hundreds of millions of dollars to pay for schools. So it's just a question of political will and political pressure to force them.
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the politics of the striking teachers. Now, in West Virginia, we have it on very good authority that there are quite a few militant leftists involved in coordinating that strike. You wrote in an article in Jackman called Red Oklahoma about a history of left activism in Oklahoma that isn't really present. But it does seem like there is potential for that growing at this point now. And I think also I want to emphasize this point because people are extremely insistent on... Sorry, that's Will's cat.
He's kissing your ear. He's playing a little flirty right now.
It's the wobbly cat.
Yeah,
really
he
excited.
Is. What was I talking about? Oh, yeah. People tend to paint the entire middle of the country with a broad brush, and there's this sense of, look, there are red states and blue states, and neither the twain shall meet. Could you talk a little bit about the political landscape?
The idea that people in between the coasts are these dupes of the Republicans is clearly widespread, and it's also been very disproven by recent events. People need to wrap their heads around that. The mass strikes that we're seeing are by these so-called... people have been written off for decades now. And what you see is when there's actually a class perspective put forward, people seize on it. Mm-hmm. And in West Virginia, we saw that. A lot of the people who were on strike voted for Trump.
Mm-hmm.
Right? These are not, by any means of imagination, radicals or leftists or even liberals.
Yeah.
So the question of just their sheer material interest in not having to leave the state and being able to pay rent, plus their very sincere commitment to their students, both in West Virginia and Oklahoma, pushed them to fight back, irrespective of what they might think about the Republicans, many of whom they'd voted for even very recently. So the difference I see in West Virginia and Oklahoma is that there's somewhat still of a, as you mentioned, a living leftist militant labor tradition in West Virginia. And I think that gets a little exaggerated sometimes. There's a really romantic view of West Virginia that doesn't actually correspond to the reality.
Yeah,
up until very recently, that labor tradition was pretty dormant at best. And so when you're actually on the ground, right to work passed. People didn't try to fight for that. So sometimes there's a danger of explaining West Virginia as this anomaly because everyone there just remembers the coal mine wars. And that's not really what's going on. You have a very small group of radicals who correctly, beginning in November, started orienting towards a strike. And I think there's big lessons there because what you see in Oklahoma is there was also radicals in Oklahoma who have organized, but they weren't involved in labor. And I think this is a crucial lesson for anybody who wants to revive a socialist movement or working class movement is the role of a small group of dedicated radicals in the labor movement is crucial. If you don't have that, then you get Oklahoma right now, in which workers were just as militant, the support was just as high, but the accumulated organizing experience and lessons that the leadership of radicals in West Virginia was able to push forward through the struggle hasn't existed in Oklahoma. And it's one of the reasons why it's more disorganized and why the strike appears to be at an impasse.
Yeah. You brought up one of my favorite buzzwords earlier, which is spontaneity. People, I think, now really love the idea of like, oh, these spontaneous protests, which is like, one, like, not true. Like, it's... these things require a lot of planning. And two, it's like deeply insulting because the amount of coordination and especially experience that goes into this is just mind-blowing. And the problem with union organizing, too, is that you are actually going to lose more battles than you win. That's especially now. You lose some things and you make mistakes and you start to build organizational capacity and then you do better next time. Do you think that this could be sort of like a long fight kind of situation?
Yeah, well, clearly the struggle on a national level isn't over. And even in Oklahoma, there's no way of saying what will happen on Monday. And the struggle, by no means of imagination, is over. People are mobilized. And there's a dynamic. When you have a mass strike, no matter what happens, the amount of people who've gotten politicized in the span of 2 weeks is really remarkable. It's hard to put that genie back in the bottle, right? People have a sense of power. No matter what happens, people have a sense of power that's going to be hard to dissipate. So I think both in Oklahoma and more generally, what we see after West Virginia is a real strike wave. It is a strike wave. And the ripple effects of that are continuing very broadly. This coming Monday, there's going to be a walkout of teachers in Colorado. Arizona is still potentially planning a strike. North Carolina is going to have a walkout in May. And so what you see is because these conditions of attacks on public education are so generalized, the sense that these aren't inevitable, that you can fight back and win, that you can strike and win, that idea has already caught. And I think we should expect that to continue to rumble across different states. The big question is how we get that to the quote-unquote blue states where you have entrenched liberals who don't want that to happen. And that hasn't happened yet, and that's going to require more organization.
As this moves to other states, you alluded briefly to what some alternatives to an electoral model or just remember in November as being kind of a dead end. You alluded to some other alternatives. For these other states, what would your advice be about what a winning or a strategy that has a potential to win would look like?
Right. Well, the first thing I would say is people don't really like too much advice from New Yorkers telling them what to do. So I'll be a little general on this. The conditions on the ground are very particular in every place. And one of the things I would say about Oklahoma is the danger in assuming that there's a model that you just 1, 2, 3 Facebook group strike, bam, you win. That being said, there's some general lessons that we can point to. One is clearly strikes work, right? This is maybe controversial in the labor room. It shouldn't be, but the idea that the way you're going to win is by withholding your labor has not been an idea, to say the least, that widely accepted. That the norm in the labor movement generally has been lobbying the Democrats, work within the legal confines that exist. And it's been a dead end. So the first thing is strikes work, even threats of strikes work. And that also requires breaking the law. The law right now makes it almost impossible to have a successful work stoppage, particularly when it's not just in one job. So I think if you're talking about the necessity for strikes, the need to break labor law, the need for solidarity, one of the big reasons that West Virginia succeeded and why Oklahoma had such widespread support is that the teachers clearly weren't just fighting for themselves. They were fighting for staff workers, all of the people in the education system, and they were fighting for, more broadly in West Virginia, healthcare for all, right? Which is obviously an issue for most working class people, and they were fighting for students. So the working class movement historically has been for the class as a whole and not just for the individual workers involved. And so bringing back that level of militancy, that level of solidarity, those are generalizable lessons. How you do that at a specific moment and place is probably best left up to organizers and not up here. But I think that there's a lot of inspiration at the very least.
Going to disagree with you and say they should definitely listen to people from New York City and Brooklyn in particular about everything.
On this
and
couch.
Probably this show. Only this show.
Who may or may not be wearing their slippers, their grandpa slippers inside right now?
Well, I'm inside. That's what slippers are for.
Not everything, but definitely labor strategy and salsa. That we make the best salsa and y'all should make salsa like we do.
I didn't realize I was supposed to wear slippers.
I remember it was Nevada Demuchamdar who said in a labor talk, she said people are really concerned about breaking the law, but when you actually like broach the topic and you're like, I think she said they're like, we can't break the law. But she's like, it's not God's law. You can break the law. Like, just break the law. Like, it's fine. She's like, there are repercussions.
Cool.
She's like, there might be repercussions and you should measure out, you know, do a cost benefit analysis. But this is fundamentally, you know, a moral fight that you're doing. And sometimes that involves breaking the law.
One of the really remarkable things in West Virginia was the amount of people who had signs explicitly tying their struggle and breaking the law to the civil rights movement. So you have a lot of lily white teachers who, many of whom probably voted for Trump and who you could easily dismiss as backwards racist reactionaries, which I don't think is generally the case, holding up signs saying Rosa Parks was right to break the law. We should do the same thing. So there's a level of continuity with the civil rights movement that I didn't expect, and which again undercuts this idea of deep red state conservatism that people are such entrenched racists and dupes of the Republicans that they're incapable of understanding solidarity with other people or even their own interests.
I sort of wanted to ask if there was any kind of across state coordination. It seems like people are in contact, but I can't tell how formal it is. Obviously, like West Virginia has been building this kind of, for lack of a better word, parallel union structure that is more active and militant and to the left of the union leadership for a very long time. And Oklahoma has not, but it does seem like they're sharing notes. Would you say you've seen any of that or spoken to anyone who says as much?
Oh, definitely. Well, the first thing to say is just because the strike was so recent, everyone followed it very closely. So the level of knowledge of what happened there, at least amongst the core activists, was relatively widespread. And there's been, because of Facebook, one of the good things about Facebook is it's allowed for people to have these back and forths relatively easily. So yeah, there has been active discussions. West Virginian leaders, really to their credit, see this as a national movement and feel a responsibility to reach out to strikers elsewhere. There's been a real outpouring of solidarity, hundreds, maybe thousands at this point, of solidarity photos, including by West Virginian teachers. It's really kind of inspiring,
yeah,
where you have teachers taking their time off to say, we're with you, Oklahoma. And they really do see that. They really feel like they started something. And the amount of discussion has grown a lot in the last week. I think also one of the things that we're seeing more now is that with the Oklahoma strike potentially having reached an impasse or it's unclear what's happening, there's more of a interest in learning what actually happened in West Virginia. It was more difficult. So even just this last weekend, there's very intense discussions amongst West Virginian strike leaders, the militants, with people in Oklahoma on how to organize a wildcat or what did they actually do. It wasn't just Facebook. So I think that sometimes maybe it made it look too easy. West Virginia just, as you said, it was just spontaneous. People rose up and then
people
you win.
People love that idea. It's never true.
Every time you strike, you win. It's like, clearly that's not the case. And it's also clearly not the case that it's easy to organize these strikes. They just systematically made right tactical move after right tactical move in West Virginia for months. And that type of organizing, that type of political strategy is hard for others to replicate without learning from them. So luckily they are reaching out, and I think we should expect more of that.
Well, because people are having to, like you said, like relearn what it means to even have a labor movement, like literally. I mean, people, even the few people left in this country who are members of unions, like that basically just means dues and then you sign off on the contract. The idea that it carries any more of a deep responsibility or, you know, action, that's kind of been so lost that it's like dead nerves being sort of reignited to even try to figure it out, which means, as you say, West Virginia is going to be very important, because if Oklahoma does end up being sort of a disappointment, then all of these other nascent movements in these other states are going to have to like deal with that and not be discouraged too much. And so there has to be learning, like you say, from the other movements that have been more successful.
Right, because there's different ways you can look at it. You could look at this and say, well, West Virginia was a one-off. Right, they had a labor tradition and they won. That's not going to happen anywhere else. I think that's not the case, and the proof will be in the pudding. We'll see what happens in Arizona and in other states. But really the factor that changed it was the level of organization, and that is hard to build, but it's doable. And luckily in some of these other states are also learning, not just from West Virginia but also Oklahoma now, and they haven't, By everything we've seen, they haven't thrown in the towel in other states yet. And in fact, it continues to spread. So the political generalization of all of these experiences is going to be ongoing for months. And luckily, we can actually have these debates now, right? In the past, we had to discuss in the 30s or, you know, what happened back then, and it seemed like the distant past. For tens of thousands of militants, teachers, and young people and socialists, we're able to look at what's actually happening and try to draw the lesson. So I think that's very exciting.
Yeah. I think it's just, it's incredibly exciting to me because I've been waiting for a very long time for people to be like, oh, remember these old tools like the strike and the slowdown and, you know, sabotage and things like that. Those worked, and those are still the tools that work, and we have to do, I mean, capital is very cagey, so we still have to be creative in organizing and everything, but it's still the same tools, and literally only workers can shut it down. A lot of unions have, I think, shifted over to try to do sort of kind of social movement based stuff, which has been like very kind of mixed at best.
If you're being generous.
Yeah. It's been a big fucking failure. And I understand, because you kind of want to go where the fire is, and you're like, well, people are marching in the streets for this or that, and if we do this and we can associate and, you know, build off their fire. But it's like, no, this kind of like general free-floating sentiment is just never going to give you the kind of material political power that a militant organized labor movement will.
Right. That's the big lesson, I think, is that still our power is primarily at the workplace in our ability to withhold labor. Now, that is a really simple thing. We don't need to reinvent the wheel. But that, as an idea, is something that even most socialists, I would argue, in this country haven't yet been fully won to, yeah. Right? There's this idea that, well, there's a bunch of different struggles. We're going to support them all, which is great. I think we should. We need to fight against all forms of oppression. We need to do all of that. Yeah. But at the same time, we need to be strategic. Where do we focus our energy? Where do we focus our work?
Yeah.
And that hopefully will be a lesson that can be learned from this, is that, yeah, if we're going to fight and win and not just fight to bear moral witness, then we need to have a real base in working class communities and in workplaces that are strategic. And I think that's teaching, healthcare, and logistics. It's not a mystery. People have been arguing this. Proof's in the pudding now, and so it's a question of doing it.
Yeah, nurses, teachers, truckers, drivers, things that are not easily replaced. We really do have to like be strategic about this stuff.
Eric Blanc, thank you so much for joining us and talking about the teacher strikes in Oklahoma and now hopefully much of the rest of the country as well.
Yeah, we hope to be in touch again because we know that this is going to keep happening.
The producers have passed me the note. Chapo Trap House does not support industrial sabotage.
When nights are cold and lonely, stand by your man and show the world you love him. Keep giving all the love you can.